What are the chances that life just arose through unguided materialistic forces, as in evolution? We're going to talk about that right now with Dr. Douglas Axe. He's the author of a book called Undeniable: How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life Is Designed. Dr. Douglas Axe earned his PhD at Cambridge University, and he is the founder and director of the Biologic Institute, a nonprofit research organization launched by Discovery Institute in Seattle. Dr. Axe, so great to have you on the program. Thank you.
It's great to be here. The PhD was actually Caltech, not Cambridge.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, but you did some studies at Cambridge, though.
I did postdoctoral work at Cambridge, yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay. I guess I misread that. Okay. Sorry about that. So, anyway, let's get to it. On page 15 of your book, you describe yourself as a quote-unquote Darwin doubter. So I want to ask you, when and how did you become a Darwin doubter as a scientist?
Well, I don't think I was ever a Darwin believer, and I have not been a Christian from early childhood. It was only in my mid-teen years, that I became a Christian. And I don't think I ever found the Darwinian story to be persuasive. But I don't think I saw a whole lot at stake in it until I became a Christian and I started to see this clash of worldviews between one account of how we came to be here and another. And that's when my mild skepticism became curiosity and stronger skepticism. And when I started to think about how you would go about doing science that would actually put this theory to the test. And that's what I ended up doing.
Hmm. Now, you described in the book one time you were in a class and the fellow was describing just the amazing way in which certain aspects of the cells or whatever. And if I could just go ahead and quote you from it. You were astonished when your biochemistry instructor revealed the elegance of the automatic decision makers working on the molecular scale to keep the various chemicals of life at the right levels. The connection to ear engineering was so strikingly and delightfully obvious to me that I felt laughter well up. As if anticipating my reaction, the instructor was quick to attribute these ingenious molecular decision makers to unguided evolutionary processes. His message was clear: however remarkable these molecular control systems may be, they should be considered nothing more than natural accidents, just like everything else in biology. Huh? I didn't believe him. I knew instinctively anyway that no string of accidents could possibly be so clever. This is good writing. I like this. I'm reading from your book, of course, Undeniable: How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life Is Designed. That was like an aha moment for you in your life?
It was. It was the first point where I had a strong connection made between engineering and biology. Because at that point, I had a degree in chemical engineering from UC Berkeley. I had embarked on graduate studies at Caltech and was just trying to figure out what I was going to do for my PhD. And was thinking about biochemical engineering and took these courses on molecular genetics and biochemistry. And it was in one of those courses that the professor was describing how genes are turned on and off and even regulated in the level. They're set to a certain level of expression within the cells based on the need of the cell. And when he was describing the mechanism for one of these genes, I thought, this is remarkable engineering. This is like what I was studying as an undergraduate in process systems control as a chemical engineering student, but far more elegant and on a sub-microscopic scale. So I was blown away. And at that point, I thought, hey, maybe the way to think about testing Darwinism is to think like an engineer. What would you have to do to make these things come into being? And can an accidental process possibly do it? So that kind of guided my thinking from that point on.
And could it? Or can it?
It can't, it turns out.
It cannot?
I was highly skeptical. An accidental process cannot produce things that look engineered in this way. And that's really the main theme of the book, of Undeniable. And so I start the book with our basic intuition, where we all look at living things and intuit that they were made by a godlike designer, and this is not controversial. The controversial thing is whether that intuition is correct or not. And what I show in the book, just through simple everyday experience and common sense reasoning, is that, in fact, that particular intuition is correct. It's solid. And you can go into the lab, as I did for 25 years, and test it rigorously, or you can just think about it carefully and use common sense, and either way you come to the same conclusion. Accidental processes cannot invent remarkable things, and that's what we see in life.
Are you saying that Darwinism is wrong?
Yes.
Okay, are you saying, well, what about neo-Darwinism? That's a phrase I hear sometimes.
Well, maybe I should qualify this. It's not that there's nothing right about neo-Darwinism. It's that it does not explain the origin of remarkable things. So does it explain how, you know, the annual flu virus can evade our immune systems from last year's version of the flu, and then we all catch the flu and have to get our antibodies have to retooled to recognize the latest version of the flu? It explains that kind of thing. It doesn't explain the origin of new things, the origin of remarkable new things, and life is filled with remarkable things.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I first heard about you through the book Darwin's Doubt by Stephen Meyer, who's also, by the way, with the Discovery Institute. And I've interviewed him, by the way, multiple times on this radio program. And one of the lines made in that book, Darwin's Doubt, is Darwin may have taught us about the survival of the fittest, but it is inadequate to teach us about the arrival of the fittest. And I thought, you know, that's a really great point. And that's like kind of what you were just saying a moment ago. Adaptation, we can learn from Darwinism, but not when it comes to the origins. And the name of his book, by the way, is On the Origin of the Species.
Right, and that's the one thing he didn't actually explain.
Isn't that interesting? Well, is evolution possible?
Again, it depends on what you mean by that.
Is macroevolution possible?
And I don't use the macro micro words because people just think big and little when you talk about that. If you look at dogs and dog breeds, you have little dogs and you have big dogs, and they're all dogs. And they did arrive. We did arrive at these by taking very genetically diverse original wild dog populations and breeding them, looking for selecting interesting traits, and then you end up with these remarkably different dog breeds. Not all species show that extreme level of variation, but dogs are an example of what you could call a macro change, because a Chihuahua is very different in size from a Great Dane, for example. But they're both dogs, and all these breeds are dogs. There isn't anything fundamentally different about them. You just have differences in scale. That kind of thing, changes like that, can be had by artificial selection, and I think things like that, typically not on that extreme scale, can also be had by natural selection in the wild. What you can't get from natural selection is the invention of something completely new, and you can't get that from artificial selection either. We didn't invent something new when we bred dogs. We just refined things that already existed.
I see. So, I mean, ultimately, the whole question gets back to, well, where did all this come from? Where did life even come from,
right,
and so forth? Well, let me ask you this. As a scientist, here's an important question. Is there, if you will, a suppression of scientific evidence or scientific results that don't fit the narrative of evolution, you know, in the Darwinian evolution or neo-Darwinian evolution or whatever, and therefore we're not told about those results, but they're important for us to know about?
There is, and this is, I actually devote a fair amount of the book to this very subject, trying to get people who are not scientists to see how very human the scientific enterprise is. And because scientists are human, you would think, duh, of course the scientific enterprise has to be human. But somehow we have collectively, I think, come to believe the myth that the scientific method somehow rids the scientific enterprise of all the human flaws that crop up so regularly in other human endeavors like politics and big business. There are other human endeavors where we look at things going wrong and we say it's because of selfish people and politics and all these things make other pursuits go wrong. But somehow I think we've bought the story that the scientific method somehow prevents things from going that badly wrong within the sciences. One of the things I want to show in the book is that's not actually true, that politics, selfish behavior, all these things that touch every other human endeavor, they touch science very deeply. And as a result, you can have a scientific idea that's wrong that becomes entrenched and orthodox within the scientific community. And once that happens, the scientists who are the gatekeepers of that community don't want contrary evidence to be brought to light. They don't want the sacrosanct ideas to be challenged. And so people who come up through the ranks and try to challenge them are punished in a way. They're not allowed to publish. They don't get grant money. They're removed from.
They're expelled.
They don't get tenure. They're expelled from the system,
right,
so to speak. Yeah. And that happened to me. And so I tell that story in the book as a way of showing people that, not as a way of complaining, but to try to give us a more realistic idea of how science actually operates. It's humans acting like humans. Surprise, surprise, when you challenge ideas that have become sort of the orthodoxy in a field, you meet resistance.
Well, could you briefly share your own story? I mean, very briefly, but what happened to you?
Well, I was working at the I was working in Cambridge at the Medical Research Council Center, and the director of the center was Sir Alan First. He knew that I had a connection to Discovery Institute because Discovery had been funding me, and there was no issue with that. But things got very political in the UK. This was back in 2002. Because a school in the UK was teaching intelligent design along with evolution, and people complained, and it was debated in the House of Commons. Tony Blair was the Prime Minister at the time. It was on the radio. BBC Radio was doing programs on it. And in the midst of that controversy, I could tell that the director of the center where I was working, First, was getting very nervous about the fact that he knew I had a connection to the Discovery Institute, and the Discovery Institute was being named in all of these, these programs as being the funder of ID work. And at one point, I got an email from his assistant saying I had to vacate within 2 weeks. I went to go try to have a conversation with him, and he avoided me. He wasn't there when they gave me a going away party, as was the custom. And it wasn't until many years later that I actually met up with him face to face and had a conversation with him.
Mm. That's sad. Well, let me ask you this. Would you say that Darwinism in any way impedes the actual advance of science? Because they have this predetermined conclusion, and therefore only the things that, as I said earlier, fit the narrative is what is allowed. And so at the end of the day, you know, like 100 years from now, or maybe 200, you know, when this is all corrected, people will look back and say, I can't believe they forced Galileo into to confess that something that he didn't agree with or whatever. I mean, that's the way we look at Galileo and the Catholic Church, you know. But you see what I'm saying? Does Darwinism impede the advance of science?
Yeah, it does. And I think more generally, any time the scientific community holds dogmatically to its key ideas and doesn't allow people to challenge them, you're impeding science. Because science is supposed to operate by people being able to think freely about things, being able to have contrary opinions and marshal evidence for those opinions. And every now and then a contrary opinion will turn out to be correct. But you can't see that if you don't even allow people to pursue that project. So there are a number of examples. A good one is the case of junk DNA. You might remember that term that was used so frequently not that many years ago. When the Human Genome Project was being undertaken, people were talking about 98% or something like that of the human genome being junk. And what the only fact behind that got confused is that it appeared that about 2% of the human genome is encoding proteins. So you have genes that are actually encoding proteins that make up a small part of the genome. And because biologists believe that we evolved and our origin is the Darwinian origin, they expected that much of our DNA would be just junk. It's these sort of evolutionary experiments, most of which go wrong, and occasionally they stumble upon something good. And the good things were the 2% and the 98 was the, you know, things gone wrong. Well, once you label the majority of our genome as junk, you're basically telling people don't bother studying this because it's junk. And you can imagine young graduate students who are trying to formulate research projects, why would they want to study the junk in the genome? Recently, in relatively recent years, it's turned out that it's not junk. We find that the vast majority of our genome is being transcribed, so RNA is being made from the DNA, and there are very remarkably complex interactions that these RNAs are having. We still don't understand how the genome works, but it's become much more clear in recent years that the genome is active and it's functioning, and what we were calling junk by mistake.
Wow. All right, we're out of time, but thank you so much for being with us. I guess at the end of the day, settled science, so-called, is an oxymoron. UndeniableDesign.com for more information. Douglas Axe, again, the author of the book, Undeniable. Thanks again for being with us. God bless you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye now.